morning, everybody. We'll call CNRA meeting to order at 8:06. Let the record show we have Representative Cisna, Representative Mark Newman.
Williams,
yes. Everybody calls me Williams. Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Thomas present. And today we have a presentation by the Local Boundary Commission, and today we have Daryl Hargraves, the Chair, and Dan Brockhorst, the Executive Director, is that?
Staff.
Staff to the Commission. So at this time, we'll like both of you to come up. This one come one at a time and tell us the good news, all the great things you've done.
Well, the good news is we were on time.
Good news you got in here.
Well, I was planning to come and apologize for running a little late because I found out that Mr. Brockhorst has to have two bowls of oatmeal for breakfast. And so if had we been late, I was going to blame him.
Oatmeal.
Well, goes downhill, they say, you know.
He eats two big bowls of oatmeal.
I need to start eating oatmeal.
Well, I can go one, but two was a record that I've never seen before. Members of the committee, Chair Olson, Chair Thomas, I'm Daryl Hargraves of the Local Boundary Commission, and I am the chair of that commission. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you here this morning. The commission has had some activities this past year that we will report to you. I have with me Mr. Dan Brockhorst, who is the staff person that serves the commission and helps us with the many items that we're confronted with. Mr. Chair, last year the commission came before you with a very unusual type of report. We put special effort into that activity last year because that was the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the Constitutional Convention. And so we took that opportunity to lay a pretty good size report before you and do an extra effort in the presentation to you. The intent of that document was to provide a resource for years to come to members of the legislature and to staff people. And so I would just refer you to that document and hope that you consult it from time to time in the future as you have questions about some of the history through the Constitutional Convention and to present day about what has been placed on the Local Boundary Commission. The Local Boundary Commission's report to the 206 legislature has been provided to each member of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee. You have our report that looks like this year. And as I say, it's not quite as extensive as last year's. The Commission's report addresses three principal areas. Chapter 1 provides an overview of the Commission. Chapter 2 summarizes the Commission's activities last year along with pending proposals. And Chapter 3 discusses public policy issues of interest to the Commission. I'll speak briefly about those three points. The Alaska's Constitution established the Local Boundary Commission to ensure that proposals to create cities and boroughs or alter their boundaries would be dealt with objectively and with a statewide perspective. That was quite paramount in the charge to the Commission. The Commission's responsibilities includes judging proposals that come before us in areas of incorporation of cities and boroughs, annexation to cities and boroughs, detachment from cities and boroughs, reclassification of cities, dissolution of cities and boroughs, and merger and consolidation of cities and boroughs. The Commission has other powers and obligations to establish in law, including a duty to make studies of local government boundary issues. The Commission has five members. One member is appointed from each of Alaska's four judicial districts. The fifth member is appointed at large and serves as chair. The four members of the Commission who are not able to be with us here this morning are Bob Hicks. He's the vice chair from Seward in the third judicial district. Bob Hacharik is from Barrow, the 2nd Judicial District. Mr. Tony Nakazawa is from Fairbanks, and he's the 4th Judicial District. Georgiana Zimmerle is from Ketchikan, the 1st Judicial District. As chair, I am appointed at large, and I reside in Wasilla. The governor appoints members for overlapping 5-year terms. Members serve at the pleasure of the governor. Commission members donate their time as a public service. We receive no compensation for the time we contribute to commission activities. The Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development provides support to the commission. And let me say that at this point, I don't know what motivates an individual to be on this commission. It is clear that the people who make themselves available and the people who have been appointed to the current commission and in the past with commissions that I know about, that they come because of an interest in local government. Many of them, and quite frankly, I think most of them, have had extensive experience with local government. They've worked in the area of local government, and we can look at members today who have been instrumental in helping districts, communities, develop proposals and be considered for organization. We can look at people who have advised legally municipalities across the state. The one thing that is kind of characteristic of all these people is that they have a broad involvement across the state with municipality issues. The activities in Chapter 2 is reported, activities are reported in Chapter 2, and it outlines boundary activities, including formal or prospective proposals. These are the things that have come up in the past year. Annexation by 10 city governments. Among those was a formal proceeding in which the commission affirmed the annexation of approximately 4.5 square miles to the city of Homer. The city incorporation of 4 unincorporated communities. Among those was a formal proceeding in which the commission approved, with amendments, a proposal for incorporation of a second-class city to serve the community of Nocatee, located on the northwest coast of Prince of Wales Island. Reclassification of 4 existing cities. No formal petition has been brought to us for consideration, but staff has worked with those cities. Annexation by 3 borough governments. No formal petitions were considered, and none are pending at this time. Consolidation of a borough and city government. One formal petition is pending before the commission for consolidation of the city of Ketchikan and the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. Detachment from 4 boroughs. Now, in these instances, there is no formal petition pending, but there are groups within those boroughs that have presented themselves asking questions, seeking information from staff, and in some instances appear pretty set on carrying forward with a proposal. Borough incorporation in 11 unorganized areas. Mr. Chairman, I think that this probably presents a record. I think what it illustrates to us that there's considerable interest in the state right now in various locations, more interest than I've ever seen before, for considering some kind of incorporation. In connection with those borough incorporations, there is one petition for borough incorporation at the present time, the Deltona Borough, and that is pending before the commission. The policy issues that are dealt with in Chapter 3 contains a discussion of public policy issues of particular interest to the Local Boundary Commission. The issues were raised in the Local Boundary Commission's annual report last year and in previous years. In brief, the issues relate to a lack of adequate inducements for incorporation of organized boroughs and annexation to existing boroughs, a lack of standards providing for establishment of unorganized boroughs, and funding for borough feasibility studies. The commission is pleased that the legislature is considering various measures to address incentives for the formation of organized boroughs. Those incentives, we recommended heartily to you last year, and we feel that there's still need for more involvement, investigation, and final determination of what those incentives can be. Among those statutes that are out there that we're familiar with at the current time is HB 217, which would exclude the value of oil and gas that is not taxed by a municipality in the determination of the required local contribution to for schools. And Mr. Chair, I would add that some of the borough requests that we're contemplating receiving at some point in the near future, this will be a vital concern to those areas, if that can be accomplished.
But question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hargraves, you said that that could be a vital concern to some of the communities, HB 217. Is this a positive concern, a negative concern? What are the questions at some of these areas? I'm assuming, again, that we're talking about the gas line proposals, whether they be from Prudhoe to Valdez or Prudhoe down through Canada, the Trans-Canada line. Is that where you're talking about, is these areas?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, that is correct. We, what you will see coming before you are those communities that have a portion of the pipeline running through it. And if that high assessed evaluation were included in the assessed evaluation of the borough, quite frankly, they just couldn't afford to organize. But when you exclude that from the determination, in providing a local contribution to schools, they can, in fact, then organize, and local people could find it feasible to do that. So that puts us in support of 217, and it would be supported by those areas that would be incorporated under those circumstances.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me make sure that my right left hand here nods his head in agreement to what I just said.
Before we go on, let the record show Representative Salmon is here. You got that? Okay. Thank you. And Ledoux, yeah, she's got it. Thank you.
SB 112, that would impose a tax on certain residents and our individuals employed in the unorganized borough outside of home rule and first-class cities. Of course, other statutes could be passed which would make this a moot point. But the commission has come down in support of SB 112. One of the surprising things that happened last year in the testimony that came to you was the number of positive testimonies that came from those unorganized areas. That showed us very clearly that the people in those areas do not refuse in any way the thought that they could contribute to their schools. There's much more receptivity to some kind of tax that would make it possible for people to participate in funding their schools. The Local Boundary Commission is, and also on that point, we're well aware that you would need to put in certain types of protections for poverty level people, for people that are over Social Security age. There are things you might want to put in, but the concept of that, until if we don't get boroughs in the unorganized areas, this would be a way to provide some local funding in support of the schools. The Local Boundary Commission is aware of the work done by the Alaska Advisory Commission on local government this past year during the interim between sessions. And members of the Local Boundary Commission and staff will respond to any questions or concerns they wish to direct to the commission as they consider their work within the structure of that advisory commission. I think, in fact, our staff has been called on. The commission itself has not had any involvement or any positions. The Local Boundary Commission continues to support greater incentives for borough incorporation. We expressed heartily last year that it was much more receptive to us to have incentives than to have sticks. I think that's just makes things work more smoothly. The Local Boundary Commission urges the legislature to make funding available for regions to explore borough incorporation. You have some places that would like to consider borough incorporation, But they, and you know, they depend on bake sales. They raise money from different ways. But quite possibly what they need is some kind of incentive as a contribution that will let them have money to hire the expertise and to do the studies that are necessary and develop their petition for incorporation. There will have to be controls put on that, but it's very clear to us that one of the things that holds people back is just having the professional expertise and the finances to develop an incorporation petition. That concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Be happy to answer any of your questions. If there are technical questions I can't come up with the answers on, I'd like to be able to refer to Mr. Bockhorst.
Questions? Mr. Newman?
Chair, just a few questions here. Senate Bill 112, was that the $500 head tax?
Was it 500?
Current estimates, based on the information available, would be about $470 annually. It would apply to individuals 21 years of age or older, up to 65, that were not below federal poverty guidelines. It would exempt disabled veterans and would also exempt individuals that were property taxpayers elsewhere. And it would apply only to individuals and individuals that resided in or were employed within regional educational attendance areas outside of home rule and first class cities.
Senator Bundy's bill?
Correct.
Two more questions, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Last year the committee agreed that there should be two meetings held in areas to be annexed. Have you gone forth with that proposal? With the thought being that a lot of times in communities after meetings for annexation or other meetings happen, the media comes out and advertises it, and people go, oh, what was that? You know, I think there's a little bit of shock that goes along with some of these folks. And so it was the thought of this committee that maybe two meetings could be held in communities to be annexed so that people would have a second chance to get out there after they heard a little bit of the facts of the first meeting, learned a little bit more information about what was going on, and then could come back and work on that and vote on that again with two separate meetings. Has that been followed through?
I'm not quite frankly sure I recall that recommendation. But the sequence of hearings that takes place, you'll have public information hearings that starts very early in the process. Numerous times staff will go on site and meet with various interest groups, and then after all of the written testimony has been brought into the record, the commission itself goes on site and meets. And usually that meeting, depending if it's a full borough, it might be a full 2 days of hearings. And then after that, all of the testimony, all of the written material put into the record is considered, and the commission makes its decision. Now, are you saying there should be a second meeting of the commission on that site?
No, Mr. Hargrave. I believe that you said not the commission, but I guess actually through the commission, yes, that I guess House Bill 133 that was possibly could have been the one which was passed unanimously in the House, according to my notes here. So maybe you could go back and look at that. And what it said that is, when you do have, believe in a nutshell, and I'm going back on memory here, is when there's an area to be annexed, you should, you know, you have area A wants to annex area B, and generally area B is a smaller area with less finances. A lot of times people go in there and they get a wake-up call of them. They find out that they've just been annexed into another community or, you know, with a vote, and we decided, this committee decided, and again passed unanimously in the House, that there should be at least two meetings in those communities to discuss those issues with the people.
And that's House Bill 133?
Correct. Also, I believe also included in 133, I believe it was about annexation, and it had to do with the idea that Right now, annexation is done in an aggregate vote, and I believe it dealt with the fact that both areas, Area A and Area B, should approve the annexation vote as opposed to an aggregate vote, with the pretense being that a lot of times the larger community, we'll say Wasilla and Big Lake, just because they're in my communities and familiar with myself, or Meadow Lakes, closer to Wasilla. Meadow Lakes may want to form their own community, but they're just not there yet with their organization efforts, similar to what's going on in Delta right now, in Fairbanks, where Wasilla would like to take over the Meadow Lakes area to get the financial benefits because of the values of the land and increase their tax base and their authoritative power. And the way the rules are right now with the Local Boundary Commission, if Wasilla proposed to annex Meadow Lakes, it would be an aggregate vote. Well, there's a lot more people in Wasilla. They would probably, and it's shown historically that those larger areas tend to vote yes to try and increase their tax base, which helps reduce their tax. But the people in Meadow Lakes generally don't approve of that, or a lot of times I think in the smaller areas don't approve of that. So I think this committee, and I believe that's what 133 said, yes, that both areas, Area and B, A and B, both have to vote separately, and they both have to be a yes vote.
Representative Newman, through the chair, that is in regulation. Let me speak, Mr. Chair, if I might, to those regulations. The last activity in the revision and the major development of those regulations was in the early 1990s. I think a very thorough and good job was done at that time. But it has become apparent to the Commission, and I've looked at it extensively myself, that it's probably time to have a major revision of those regulations. And we have, in fact, been able to get the Commissioner of the Department to assign staff to work with us in the development of a new set of regulations. The input that you just given is very good for us. We need to hear that. And as those regulations are developed and as the public hearings are announced and we receive public comment, the end result will eventually be a new set of regulations revised to take in the major concerns of the state at this time. Your point's well taken. I've heard you. That no doubt will be a major consideration in the development.
Okay, other questions?
I've got one.
Yes.
It's been about 4 years since the Homer annexation began. At that point in time, I was working for the senator who represented that district, and the annexation process was painful to the people in the community, and it was definitely painful to us. It took up a good portion of our time for the entire session. It looks like it's winding down now. I wonder if you could tell us where it's at and what you would do differently if you had a hostile annexation like the one that took place in Homer come up again in the near future.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have pending court suits in that case, don't we?
Correct.
So please give me a little leeway to not talk about the specifics there. But it's interesting, sometimes we go into communities and we make a decision, and quite frankly, the hearings process itself is sometimes kind of a negotiations, kind of a give and take. For example, you can have a community where the larger community decides it's important to annex an area. The annexed area, through the process, can become pretty much convinced that's the appropriate thing for them. I won't say that was 100% the case of Homer, but there's a lot of positives that came out of that. And the people, I think that city council out there right now has two council members on it from that annexed area. When we went out for the follow-up hearings after the court decision, and we were a new commission, so we hadn't gone through the original decision out there. But the thing that impressed me was how positive the testimony was, how many people supported that position. were a couple of people outside of the incorporated area that really opposed it. But the truth is, that seemed to be a pretty positive annexation, and people accepted it very well, from my experience, from what I saw.
Follow up.
I'm reaching back on this, but I believe the original annexation was for approximately 25 miles, square miles.
Yes.
And then it was finally approved at 4.5. Is that correct?
Yes, and that's why I say that many times the hearings processes themselves is kind of an arbitration thing. The commission sits there, and we see people give and take. We had another case of a second-class city this past year that had a very large area that they wanted to annex. The people in the peripheral of that area just really took that badly. They were not going to be annexed. They just weren't going to have it. The opposition could have possibly scuttled the whole process of annexation. But in the process, before the commission got to the hearings, the parties agreed to a reduced boundary. And that was what finally got approved. So I hope I got enough in there to answer part of your question.
I think so. I realize there was pending litigation going on and that you wouldn't be able to go into a tremendous amount of detail. But thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
My understanding is that in some of these unorganized boroughs, there are REEAs that get federal funding. Is there any possibility that if some of these places are organized, that it may result in a net loss of dollars because there would be a loss of federal funds?
Well, that's a little bit out of our expertise. I happen to know a little about that, so I'll try to answer that question somewhat, but probably not as a commission. But the REAAs do get part of their PLH 74 now. If they become a borough school district, then more of the PLH 74 would go directly to them, reducing the amount that would go to the state. The answer is yes.
So they would get more, but the state would get less?
Of the PLH 74 payment, yes.
But the net amount of dollars wouldn't be affected?
To the school district?
Yeah, yes.
Well, it would the net dollars in the PLH 74 payment would increase.
No, what I meant is the net amount of dollars going to a combination of the state and the school district. That wouldn't change as a result of borough.
From the feds? No. The total would stay the same.
So nothing involved in borough formation could result in a net loss of federal dollars. Is that what I'm hearing?
No. The federal PLH 74 is earned totally on the basis of people who live on or work on federal lands. And in that classification, there is a classification of non-restricted deeds that some people live on. And that money, the feds would pay the taxes on those properties.
Right.
But that won't change. There's nothing in borough formation that would change the total dollar from the feds.
All right, thank you.
Kind of a follow-up in just in regards to Yukon Flats REAA. It says in here that their total taxable property value is $340 million, of which $316 is the TAPS pipeline. Now, if they formed a borough, would the state lose that $316 million and would go to the borough?
It could.
If they go to the 20 mills.
As it is right now, in fact, that's the way it would be. The local borough would tax a portion of that. Suppose they set their millage at 10 mills and collected 10 mills on that pipeline property. Under current statute, I think, and Dan, you correct me if I'm wrong on the technicalities here, but the rest of the 20 mills would come to the state. The state collects 20 mills
correct.
On those properties now. And the statute allows the local municipality, borough, to collect a portion of it, which the state reduces from the 20 mils.
And kind of a follow-up on that, isn't there, I recall a while back that we gave the authority to local municipalities to allow them to discount like the first 50,000, is it, or 25,000 on their homes? Do you remember? Maybe you don't.
I think it's 50,000. I believe it's 50,000.
Okay, so how would that work on the taps? They would have to give the first discount on the 50,000, and then, so if they, let's say the borough or the Yukon Flats REA initiated that, they can give a discount on the first 50,000 property value of their homes and still fully tax at 20 mils to the pipeline?
That is correct, and this also interrelates to House Bill 217 that was discussed previously, that the only way a Yukon Flats borough government could benefit from the Trans-Alaska pipeline there would be to levy a property tax. And based on the figures that were in that report that was prepared by the University of Alaska graduate students last year, they indicated that roughly 93% of the taxable value of property within the Yukon Flats region related to the Trans-Alaska pipeline. And so the only way they could access that would be to levy a property tax, which there was not a lot of interest in levying property taxes. So if House Bill 217 were passed, it would remove the ability, and they would have to voluntarily agree to this.
That's the key.
They would not be able to levy the property tax, but their required local contribution in support of schools would go way down because that value would not be included in the calculation.
Okay, and just because that's interesting with that, the pipeline in there, if you build a gas line, let's say that's another $200 million. So in essence, by us encouraging the Yukon Flats to become a borough, we could lose $500 million in revenue if I was sitting there and I knew the gas line was coming through and they're looking at drilling for natural gas in that area. The infrastructure at 20 mils and a $50,000 deduction for your property, I think we start losing, is the way I look at it. And, you know, that comes out of general fund money, I imagine.
Well, those facts are correct. That's the way it's correct.
Just one point to clarify. The $500 million is not revenue. That's the property tax base.
Right.
So it'd be 2%, 20 mils, 2% of $500
million.
Yeah.
It's still a loss to the, yeah. Other questions? Because I've got a bunch.
One.
North
Star Borough, is there anything going on?
There's no formal petition. We've had any inquiries from those folks?
Through the chair, the Fairbanks North Star Borough early in 2005 did express serious interest in exploring the merits and prospects of annexation, and the mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough indicated in published reports in newspapers that he had reached a preliminary conclusion that annexation of territory north to the Yukon River and south to the Good Pasture River was economically viable. However, as the chairman of the Local Boundary Commission indicated, there has been no formal initiation of any annexation proposal by the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and we are not aware of any that is in the works.
Yeah, thank you. I believe that broke right about the last time you guys were down here for an update last year.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hargrave, last year this legislature passed legislation that gave 250,000 acres to the university system. I believe it was in a land grant. With the intent that we could get another 250,000 from the federal government. When I saw this as maybe a way to help areas organize boroughs in the fact that we now have 500,000 acres that we can try and get to areas in the state, such as in Southeast, where they don't have a land mass area to create a borough. They just don't have the finances there to do it. But if we could get some of that state and federal land transferred into some of these local communities, Do you feel that that could be a possible vehicle to try and get some of these areas to organize?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the incentives of lands available in those areas that are being petitioned is a good inducement for incorporation. The inequity lies in the fact that there are not as many lands in one area as there is another. You can have situations where one area can incorporate an area that is rich in resource, and they can and can select a lot of land. And you'll go to another community that's resource poor, as far as anyone knows, and there's just not anything of value to select from. That in itself is one of those disincentives for incorporation. And anything, if it could be a transfer of federal lands to the state in those areas, anything that could put more lands out there for selection would be an incentive, I think.
Second. Yeah. My apologies, Representative Coghill, if you want to come join us up here.
I'm only going to be here a short while, so I'll
see. Okay, I didn't see you sneak in. I got so many papers here, I'm shuffling, so my apologies, but okay.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hargrave, I believe probably in the spirit of the bill, a lot of the lands that will be selected are hopefully given to the state, and this is more of a statement, I guess, than anything, would be areas that do have the potential to have some resource development opportunities. And I would just like to see the possibility of maybe this being able to use some of these communities, being able to put some of this land in their land base so that they can help organize them. Because some of these areas just don't have that ability, as you well know, and maybe this would help them out a lot.
Thank you. Kind of the stepping stone for my next question, if we don't mind. You know, during the interim, and there was a resolution passed to look at formation of boroughs, and I know you were involved with it. And I don't know if the bill's been introduced or not. I've been looking at the general language in there, and we've talked to incentives. Have you looked at any of the rough language yet for the administrative boroughs? Has it been available to you?
It has.
And can you, I know it's kind of early, but you generally agree with what we're trying to do in that?
You're talking about the department?
Yes.
Well, as far as the commission is concerned, we've heard of it. We know that it exists. We read the very early language in the draft. I personally did. I haven't followed up any subsequent revisions myself, and I don't know what the department's position is. Dan can speak to that.
Certainly the provisions in the draft bill that we saw that provide for the new grant program over the next 4 years following incorporation for $15 million for areas that incorporated that have fewer than 15,000 acres of land, and $12.5 million for regions that have 15,000 acres or more of municipal land entitlement. I think that is a huge fiscal incentive for areas, and I think that the framers of Alaska's Constitution had a vision that the Alaska legislature would create incentives that would promote borough incorporation. There have been a number of issues that have been expressed in the past by areas of the state that they view as disincentives, and one of those is the perceived loss of autonomy that occurs with regard to schools, and the bill, in terms of the administrative borough provisions, does not affect the current structure for schools. Another concern that has been expressed by individuals in the unorganized borough about borough formation is the prospect of property taxes, and of course the administrative borough concept would not empower these administrative boroughs to levy property taxes. So in that respect, the bill certainly does in those three key areas at least very significantly address impediments and disincentives that have occurred in the past. As the chairman indicated, the commission has not taken a position on the bill. There was some discussion at a meeting recently of the commission, and some commission members, while they didn't take a position on the bill, acknowledged that some regionalization is beneficial. Others seem to suggest that, you know, going and creating a new structure that doesn't address education on an area-wide basis may be problematic from an equity standpoint. So at this point in time, outside of acknowledging that the bill does address those three very major disincentives, you know, I'm certain that there are other issues that will have to be addressed as the bill moves through the legislative process.
I, just for the committee's sake, one of the key factors in that the incentives only good for 4 years.
Yes.
If you do not form within a 4-year period, those go out the window, out the door, and you go back to the old formula. So if you want to form a bureau or even consider one, you have to do it immediately. Or I know that it would be nice if the bigger the better, you know, for boroughs. And I know I've talked to a couple of mayors in Southeast that who are somewhat excited at the fact that there is this incentive out there, because under their potential creation of boroughs, only like 2,300 acres. That's not a lot of land for a borough to form, and you'd have probably states. I mean, they'd be bigger than some states down south, and they'd only have 2,000 acres within their boroughs. And they're crying because the 2,000 acres they would get, there's leftovers after the university came in, and we helped them high-grade everything in Southeast, so they really will have some land, but not the premium land that they wish they would have had. So, Mr. Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Blocker, just something that popped into my mind here, and I think this probably concerns the people in Southeast Alaska more than it does anybody, is the state owns the rights 3 miles off shore from the state. Would there be chances of communities in there, or I'm not suggesting this by any means, but I don't know if the option's there or not. If folks could tax any of the income that comes off of the fisheries out of those areas?
Through the chair, the jurisdiction of the state, as you indicated, does extend 3 miles offshore generally, and borough governments and most borough governments that are along the coast have similar jurisdictional boundaries, that boundaries that have been approved by the local boundary commission do extend to the same corporate limits as the state of Alaska, and there are a number of municipal governments that do generate revenue from commercial fishing activities in their areas. In fact, the Aleutians East Borough and the Lake and Peninsula Borough, the Bristol Bay Borough, all derive very significant amounts of money from municipal borough government taxes on commercial fishing activities.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Salmon.
Yes, I have a question. I know in the commission I was in last summer, I've been kind of shut down on this, but the you know how, I guess you work in Yukon Flats area before, and what usually happens is the bigger villages and this what I call satellite villages, which are the small villages that exist around the big villages, the big village kind of seemed to gobble up the, you know, resources and the money, and seemed like we're just providing jobs just for that local, you know, the big villages. And what my question is how do we get, if we were to form a borough, how do we get fair representation for the smaller villages that theoretically will be paying taxes in that area?
Representative Salmon, Chair, I'm well aware of the kind of problem you talk about there. That's regional differences, I hate to say fights, but concerns between communities like you're describing there exist all over the state. And that probably stands in the way of organization in some instances, incorporation. I don't know that the commission could come up with any answer for that. Those rivalries just exist, and I mean, that's not unique to Alaska. That's unique to counties in Midwestern states. So I don't have a solution to that. the administrative boroughs that you're talking about designing would have to have a borough seat somewhere, and you can surmise where that will likely be. And then there is an extent to which those smaller outlying areas would be left out of the loop. I guess it kind of depends on the political power and persuasions of the total community and what kind of political power the local smaller sites could bring. There is no answer, I think, within the parameters of the commission to solve that one.
Then I have just kind of one basic follow-up is that the reason why I refer to Yukon Flats area is not because it's my favorite area, it's because I live there, but we're on federal refuge, and there's few state lands. The only state land you could probably find in the village is where the airport exists, and that's basically it. The rest is federal refuge. You were talking about Fort Yukon, we're talking about Arctic, you know, Vinitar, Arctic, Chalkeetsuk, and that area. Where everywhere, I think south of Birch Creek, from there you have basically small amounts of state land. And if we were to, you know, start a borough in that area, I mean, what land basis would we use? I mean, we don't have, I mean, everywhere is federal.
And I think that's why I referred when I did to those places that are resource poor and they don't have many lands available. Again, I think that's in the purview of the legislature. I think that you have to determine how that's to be fixed. And, you know, $15 million is a pretty good incentive. You could fix a few things with that. But there's no way to consider borough formation in this state without considering the fact that there are situations like you've just described.
I have one. We kind of touched on it briefly, but on litigation, can we hear any more about any other legal matters or potential ones? I know you had Homer and Skagway. You might be still in court, I think, with Skagway, right? So we can't talk about that one, probably?
Well, there has been a court decision come down on that one, and so we're in the process of doing some rehearings, and that is a matter that's outstanding, so we couldn't discuss it too much.
Okay.
As far as other lawsuits, I think that's it. Homer continues to have individuals that are bringing suit.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Olson?
A couple years ago, there was some momentum for a proposed Prince William Sound borough. Is anything going on with that right now, or anything you can share with us?
I'd have to refer to Dan.
There was a resolution at one point that was adopted by the Whittier City Council that called on the Local Boundary Commission to consider a Prince William Sound borough. A short while later, the citizens, the voters in the city of Whittier, through a referendum, rescinded that resolution. The city council in Cordova adopted a resolution similar to the original resolution from Whittier, calling on the Local Boundary Commission to consider incorporation of a Prince William Sound borough. The department had done some preparation of petition materials for Prince William Sound borough. To my knowledge, that was not done through the Local Boundary Commission staff, but to my knowledge, that effort has ceased, and I believe the petition materials and information that was developed was made available to communities in the Prince William Sound region, in particular the city of Cordova, in the event that citizens in those communities or local governments wanted to pursue the matter. But at this point in time, no petition has been filed, and I have no indication that a petition is likely to be filed or work on the effort is proceeding at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Blackhurst, a lot of communities are developing, and this maybe has a little reference to Representative Salmon's question, a lot of communities right now are developing their own community comprehensive zoning plans or comprehensive plans, a vision how they want their community to look in their future. Going back to a little bit about House Bill 133, if we have area A, a larger area wants to annex B, a smaller area, there's a community, the area B has their comprehensive plan set up of how they want their community to look. Does that comprehensive plan that is passed in area B or the smaller community have any weight? Does it have hold any authoritative powers as far as the local boundary commission is concerned? Is certainly they have different views of how they want to look. Maybe the bigger area wants to annex and they want it to kind of conform to what they see that they should look like, but that kind of takes away from what the local people wanted in their area. Does that hold any weight? And could you give any examples of how this was dealt with in the past, where areas were annexed in, and what weight was given to the local comprehensive plans in the communities?
Through the chair, Representative Newman. In terms of the aggregate voter method and the discussion that occurred before, one thing I would like to stress is that the aggregate voter method is one of many different opportunities for annexation that can occur. A petitioner may propose a particular type of annexation, and the local boundary commission does have the ability after public hearings to amend the petition. So if a petition came in for an aggregate voter method annexation, the local boundary commission could alter that process and could require voter approval in the area proposed for annexation. And there's also procedures that allow a petition strictly for annexation upon voter approval exclusively of the area proposed for annexation. To answer your question directly in terms of the impact of local views and published positions regarding matters such as comprehensive plans and whatnot, the local boundary commission has an extensive opportunity in its proceedings for the gathering of public input and information about comprehensive plans, and other views of citizens would certainly be available to the commission and considered. What the local boundary commission renders its decisions on is based on published criteria, standards that exist in the law that are examined and applied to every annexation proceeding or incorporation proceeding, and to the extent that any comprehensive plan addresses those criteria, the commission would certainly consider that. In terms of examples where comprehensive plans in particular might have been considered by the commission, certainly there are municipal governments that in the development of their comprehensive plans do look at areas adjoining their municipal boundaries and examine questions of whether annexation would be appropriate. City of Palmer, I believe, currently is exploring the prospects, as we indicated in the annual report, the prospects of annexation, and they may be doing that in the context of some comprehensive plan efforts. But outside of that, I can't offer specific examples at this point.
Follow up. So I guess that just to summarize clearly, is the answer to that question was no, that the local comprehensive community plans really have no legal weight in areas being, you recognize them, you look at them, and you try and address them, but they really have no, but they really don't have a say right now at this point. And also in the area of aggregate vote, you said that you do look at the many ways, and you think that that you do have different tools. Have you ever used anything besides an aggregate vote of both areas?
I've been with the local boundary commission for staffed for 25 years, a little bit over 25 years, and in fact, annexations involving any type of election are very rare. Typically, there are two types of annexations that occur, for the most part, in terms of the numbers. One is the legislative review annexation process that's set out in the state statute, in which no vote is held, and the other is a process in which all registered voters and all property owners in an adjoining area petition for annexation, and there's really no controversy in those matters. There have just been a very small number of annexations that have been conducted in the last 25 years, in my experience, that involve elections. There has never been an annexation involving an aggregate vote. The option does exist, and there is one petition that is currently pending before the Local Boundary Commission that calls for an annexation involving an aggregate voter election. So it's never been done, and annexations generally by in elections are relatively rare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
To Mr. Newman, through the chair, there's one thing to consider in any kind of strategic planning. Other efforts in a community might get brought forth by the department's review before the commission ever sees it. But you could expect that some interested party on one side or the other would always get those kinds of things introduced into the record. It would be brought to the commission's attention, either through the oral testimony or through insertion into the written record. So they carry weight in the sense that we review them, and there's no, may not be any legal requirement, but it would get reviewed by the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? I have one. I have actually several yet. I know it's advise and assist in the Article 10, Section 14 says that the local government agency shall advise and assist. And then I look at Naukety's request. Naukety is in my district, of course, so I have to defend them. And they had requested for 44 square miles. How would you turn around and say advising and assisting them going from 44 square miles to 11 is advising and assisting them when you, to me, you just about gutted their ability to be successful because you took out a lodge that they had opportunity for a head tax on, or bed tax, I guess you'd call it, and create revenue for the community. So you're trying to create municipalities, and then you take out the revenue source for them. How is that assisting them in their petition for formation of local municipality?
Is that to me?
Either one. How do you decide to strip a petition?
I think in the case of Naukety, and that has been settled, and there's not been any challenges to date, so I can talk about it some. And what we had there was a community that they did annex very large area they were asking for, and it had people out in the peripheral and businesses that objected to it strenuously. Now, when I referred earlier to some negotiations, that this process includes some negotiations, I think that's a good example. By the time we got to the hearing, the department had recommended that reduced boundary. And what we found through the hearing process was that everybody agreed with it. Everybody said that was best. The lawyer that came representing people in that area that got taken out wouldn't even speak, because he said that in talking to the people in the core area of Naukety, that he was convinced that they were going to settle on the reduced boundary, that's what they wanted. So the only thing I can say is that the record indicated that that's what people ended up wanting, and that's what was approved.
Well, maybe that's where I didn't hear that they had an attorney present and Naukety didn't have one, and I guess that's where the rub would make him. If you're a big lodge owner and the potential tax on that lodge to the municipality, my understanding was about $38,000 a year. it would be good incentive for me to hire the best that I could to come in here and not be part of the petition or, you know, and so they have no recourse. But at the same time, that guy's going to be coming into town, you know, using the community and other things. And so I find that pretty alarming, especially in light of that they, last year or a year before, they applied for the petition, but they didn't have all the I's dotted, the T's crossed, and it was rejected. The university came in and swept a hell of a lot of land out of their selection area, so they end up selecting parcels that were left over by the university. And I have that, their application, the original one, which was, they didn't get it in time, but the university bill came in right after them, and Bob Loeffler's letter saying that because it wasn't done improperly in timing, they were with SOL, you know, just out of luck. And so I just feel sympathetic to a community that, and you'll hear, not in this committee, but in the building here, we're going to be building bridges for development for the future. And I always thought the bigger the better, and they should have had their boundaries recognized. But to have somebody come in and browbeat them, it was wrong. And also, I think your final decision to demand that they put a 3% sales tax and 4.5 mils, is that typical of the Boundary Commission telling a municipality what to do on when they form? I thought that was local option.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's kind of interesting. I think the commission has broad authority to just throw in all kinds of things. And when I've questioned such things as you've just mentioned, it's been reinforced to me that all the commission can add things or delete things in order to make it successful. And I guess I understand that's perhaps where the commission stands. But the commission voted to put that in, and that's the way the motion got passed. And I won't tell you that was my personal preference, but it was enough to cause me to be very concerned about approving their petition out there.
Well, what scares me then is as one of involved in the Commission for Administrative Boroughs, I have several communities in Southeast that want to form, and they go out and form these boundaries, and it's a decision of the LBC. No, we don't want you to be this big. We're going to shrink you back down here. And because of that, I talked to the senator from the other side. I don't think he put it in the bill yet, but we're going to work on it, is that if they're rejected by the local boundary commission by the request for their boundary size and you arbitrarily shrink it for whatever reason, they have the option to opt out of the administrative borough and not form a borough, period. I mean, to me, I look at some of your decisions to be disincentives more than incentives to go forward. And I think this is such a delicate matter in formation of these new boroughs and going forward to form hopefully a home rule first to second class borough, that the boundaries are the very key, and kind of rubs heartburn. But I felt better after I looked in your report here that Ketchikan is selecting within what you call the old model borough boundaries. I was going to object about them going after a land grab because of the Tongass Forest receipts, but as long as they don't go outside that, I'm not going to complain about that. But I hate people to form and then have them shrunk, I guess. And I'm hoping that they're going to form within the model borough boundaries, and then I think we won't be having this discussion and you'll be happy, and you know.
Mr. Chairman, in the case of Nocatee, it was interesting that the commission never got to consider too much the full borough that they had originally petitioned for.
Second-class
city. But we didn't get to consider it too much because all of the parties had previously agreed.
Hmm.
In that instance, I think that had we not had the concurrence of Nocatee proper, and we had approved the total original proposal, here we would have gone with another lawsuit. There would have likely been a challenge because the people in that area were just too distant from Nocatee proper to feel like that they got anything by being included in that second-class city. And this thing was so settled by the time we got there that the attorney that represented those people didn't want to speak. He said, the decision is made. We accept what Nocatee petitioners have agreed to.
Probably just as well it leaves the borough tax base now for
yeah.
them to form if they're going to leave that big lodge out of there,
yeah.
or lodges, I'm not sure what it is, so I better tell them you better get on it. There's $38,000 right there.
Yeah.
I have one other one, and it's I know Dan was still staff when Yakutat formed their borough, and they were a single community borough. Now maybe it gets a little delicate when you talk about Yakutat versus Skagway, and since you're in litigation yet, what's the difference between the Yakutat formation and the city of Skagway's formation of forming a borough, and what has changed since since Yakutat has filed in the commission?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I could speak first to Yakutat, since in a previous life I was also involved with that one.
I see that, yeah. I've been doing our research over
here. I'm not sure how the record ended up reflecting, but I made a hearty case for giving them what they asked for. And I thought that Yakutat was and still is unique in the development of boroughs. I don't apply Yakutat to any other place. I don't see Yakutat as being the equivalent. I don't see it as setting a precedent in my mind. I just felt that Yakutat was a unique situation in a sense that it wasn't the largest place in the state, but if you didn't put it there, where did you put it? It didn't connect culturally, geographically, economically. It was pretty much there. Plus, in my mind, Yakutat met all of the standards. The 1,000 permanent resident standard, I felt, was met. They could have argued about whether it was 25 short or not, but somebody else could come and say, no, there are 75 of our people that live part-time in Anchorage, but they really live down here. So I felt that the 1,000-person standard was met successfully by Yakutat. The standard that requires multiple communities. When we look at the definition of what constitutes a community, it's kind of nebulous to me. So from my perspective, I say it qualifies if it has a couple of communities. In the case of Yakutat, I felt there were three identifiable communities. Two of the communities had post offices. Two of the communities had schools. And so speaking only about Yakutat, even though it wasn't the largest geographical area, it met all of the requirements that I felt the standards required. And those standards still set today, and the standards today will be what we judge future issues on.
Was that Icy Bay then?
Icy Bay was there with a school and a post office. And then they had that airport community that was outside. And so I felt there were three distinct communities there. If you apply the standards today, in order to have a borough, you have to have 1,000 permanent residents. You have to have an REA or to have a school district in that borough. You have to have 250 students. Now, once you go past our standard, you know, it's possible, and I think that's what the court charged the commission with in the case of Skagway, was that they made up a new standard. And looking, I don't think they did, personally. I think that the record would indicate that the judge had some grounds on which to believe that they did. So she put her verdict down, and we're going to reexamine that whole issue now. But after it's all said and done, the commission will have to resort to the standards and judge these things based on existing standards.
Any other questions? Representative Newman?
Just a quick statement, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, you did, Mr. Bockers, you did suggested earlier that some of the situations that the local boundary commission deals with, maybe they need somewhat of an overhaul on what you're doing and the procedures that you use, because you haven't done that in quite a few years. May I suggest that you look at House Bill 133 maybe see what you think about that. I think that's what some of that does. And maybe give that a little bit of a thought and maybe support it in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Salmon?
I think last year, the Yukon Flats was expressing a little interest in developing a borough. We're talking about it. And this year, I think Nenana was expressing an interest. And where does those two stand at this point?
I think those were reflected in our report. And what I said to you earlier was that there had been inquiries from those communities. There has been maybe staff presentations.
Correct.
But there has been no petition received by the commission.
Thank you.
My staff has informed me that the administrative borough bill was introduced yesterday on the Senate side. So we'll see what it looks like. And we'll watch it as it goes through the process. We haven't decided whether we'll introduce it on this side, because if we beat them through the process, we don't know what it'll look like on the other side. So we said we'll wait and we'll see what the good other body will do with that bill, because we do have beliefs, at least on this side, what the bill should look like. And that's, at least I think, that maintain the incentives in there, I think, is very key. You know, we've been struggling to form these boroughs. Let's get them formed, and hopefully people go forward. Any other questions? Seeing none, we're adjourned. Thank you for both coming.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.